Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. And with us online is Dr. Myra Beth Bundy, a professor of psychology at Eastern Kentucky University and a licensed psychologist. Dr. Bundy coordinates the EKU Developmental Disabilities Specialty Clinic, where graduate students can work with children, adolescents, and adults with autism spectrum disorders and other developmental disabilities. And she's a mom with six under her roof, ages 11 through 19. We want to talk to Dr. Bundy about a recent article in the New York Times titled "Generation Agoraphobia: After Months of Lockdown, Adults Just Want to Get Out of the House. For some children, the issue is more fraught." Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Bundy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the Times article begins with a case in point. It's an 8-year-old boy, and in the first month or two of the pandemic, he appeared okay with life in the bubble. He hunched over the dining room table for hours writing screenplays for a stop-action film starring his Star Wars figures. But as the months dragged on, he seemed a little too fine with life inside that bubble. Now, says his mom, he doesn't want to leave the four walls of this house. He doesn't even want to go to the backyard. Would you say that meets the definition of the condition known as agoraphobia, or are we just kind of stretching and searching for some kind of explanation of what's happening in this pandemic?
Yeah, so agoraphobia does relate to fear of leaving the house or fear of certain public situations. I don't know if I would give, I don't know enough about that little guy to know if he meets criteria for a clinical diagnosis. But it does sort of sound like agoraphobic-type behavior. And, you know, we always say that past behavior predicts future behavior. We do have a lot of us spending a lot more time at home than usual. So I think probably not only children, I certainly think for myself, I've spent more time in my home than maybe ever before. So we're getting in the habit of being at home, and that's a big change for a lot of people.
Well, kids today are having to adjust to a lot of things, a world of very ominous warnings, of wearing masks, social distancing. Tell us what you're seeing in the children who come to your clinic.
Well, thank you so much for asking. Just before we met today, I was doing clinical supervision with the EKU PsyD graduate students in clinical psychology. And so that's where we sit and talk about our clients and plan our interventions. And so I threw it out to them. I said, I'm getting ready to talk about some adjustments that have been going on for children. And so we've come up with 8 different themes, believe it or not. I tried to make it fewer, but we came up with 8 themes that we think we're seeing. The first theme we are seeing, we think, increased referrals for child and family clients in our clinic. So more people are reaching out for therapy. And we're the EKU Psychology Clinic is working only through telehealth right now. So all of the clients that we're seeing virtually.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the feedback that you got when you were speaking with your group today.
Okay. Well, these are the things that we've thought about. So increased anxiety overall. So anxiety is, you know, sort of it's a common cold of psychological distress in all times, but certainly in this current time that we're in, we're seeing children experiencing anxiety, and that kind of fits in with the little character you introduced from the New York Times article, right? He started out enjoying being at home and then had some increased anxiety and really couldn't leave his home very easily. Also, we think that some children are reporting increased loneliness, and they're having some narrowing of their peer group. They're just not having as much access to their peer group as they would like. There's a lot of variability in how hard different families are quarantining, right? Some people are out and about quite a bit. Some people are really what I would call it hard quarantiners. So we've seen some kids whose parents either have underlying health issues or they're taking care of grandparents with health concerns, and they just really can't get out and about very much. So those kids are having some challenges with loneliness. for all of the kids that we're seeing, there have been some academic adjustments because they're either doing non-traditional instruction or if they're going back to school live, they may be on a partial week schedule or they may be having to wear masks and different kinds of, you know, face coverings and having to follow rules about social distancing. It's just been a big academic adjustment for the children. Some kids are having attentional problems with the long Zoom instruction that they're having on some days.
Mm-hmm.
Some adults are having that too, right?
Yes.
We've seen some increased suicidality and definitely increased distress. We've got adolescents in particular that are working hard to restrain their own behavior to stay home so they can keep people safe, but they may have a lot of conflict at home. So they're caught in this, you know, this tough cycle. Say home is a safe place to be, but home is where I'm having a lot of conflict and feeling pretty lousy too. So they're in a tough spot. We've seen families that are concerned about increased child behavior problems in the home. You know, you don't know exactly where that's coming from, maybe from being home more, being home altogether. This kind of segues into the next theme, which is parents that are simultaneously working and supervising their children in their home. That's a tough dual role to have there. And changing in new routines or maybe no clear routine. I think a lot of families started out with what our old routine is gone in March. Now we have to come up with a new routine. But it seems like as quarantine rules change up and down, we keep having to adjust our routines. We can't hold on to one routine. We keep having to transition. And then my last theme is children and teenagers missing milestones and feeling hopelessness about the future because they wanted to have their sporting events. They wanted to have their field trips. You know, they wanted to see their friends at school. They wanted to have a graduation. They wanted to have a prom, all these different things. And they're not sure if they're really going to happen, you know. And in some cases, the date for these events has come and gone and they didn't get to have them.
Well, of course, what's affecting children in a household also affects everybody else in a household. What's happening to families, to the family unit dealing with all this?
Well, from what we can see in our clinic, they are experiencing heightened stress. We'd be shocked if they weren't feeling stressed with everything that's going on. You know, I just think multitasking is at a high. People are just having to do a lot of things at once and adjust to all kinds of different changes. I also think families and parents are having to make some really tough decisions. Sometimes they're given choices, for example, by their school system. You know, do you want your children to return to in-person or not? What do you think? And certainly children, I know in my household, children are asking every day, Mom, can I do this? Is it safe to do this? And I have to decide. The decisions are very difficult.
Well, in more normal times, kids are going about the business of learning and developing social skills. And I guess that probably would be easier among a large household of siblings than for an only child or for a couple of children. But are you concerned that this isolation is robbing them of that very essential development?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't describe it as robbing because I think you can make an opportunity. Maybe it's taking some peer time away, but maybe it's giving them some more family time.
Hmm.
So, you know, there are a lot of different moving parts to this. But sure, I think kids are probably some children and families that are quarantining very carefully are missing some social opportunities right now. On the other hand, kids are adaptable. As you said earlier, we sure hope this won't last forever. So they'll have opportunities come back to socially interact in the future.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? We keep finding these little slivers of silver linings in this experience.
Yeah, I think so. You know, obviously, if you've had serious illness in your family or in people you care for, it's hard to see any silver lining. But for people who have been fortunate enough to stay healthy, I've heard a lot of people talk about increased family time, for example, as a silver lining.
Well, we try to end these conversations about pandemic stuff, if you will, on an upbeat, positive note. Is that possible for you? Is there some message that you can share with us that will send us off into the future feeling better?
I hope so. I wanted to share with you, Tom, I found this nice, I often turn to the American Psychological Association for resources in difficult times. They've got this nice article. It's free. Any of your listeners can look it up. It's called Parenting During the COVID-19 Pandemic. It's very short and it has some nice themes. I thought I might tell you some of the themes that it has.
Yes.
Acknowledge your emotions as a parent. Set boundaries between work, home, and school life. Establish a routine. Allow your child to connect with peers through social media, so kind of be a little more relaxed about screen time rules. Communicate with supervisors and coworkers, so your supervisors and coworkers know what you're dealing with at home if you're working with home and you're from home and your children are learning at home. And then practice self-care for yourself and your whole family as best you can. Maybe don't hold yourself to your usual standards while you're living in a global pandemic. Take care of yourself.
Give yourself a bit of a break under these circumstances.
Exactly. And give your kids a break, too.
Dr. Myra Beth Bundy, a licensed psychologist and professor of psychology at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you, Dr. Bundy.
Thank you.
Cynthia Reeser, a professor of social studies education here at EKU, is back with another in our series on teaching, administering, and learning in a pandemic. We've heard from teachers and superintendents. Now, our focus is on students.
Today, we're here with Kerrigan Medley, and Kerrigan is a senior at Rockcastle County High School in Mount Vernon, Kentucky. Kerrigan's very active. She's a high school cheerleader, she's on the student council, and she's a member of several other clubs. And in the future, she hopes to work in the field of public health or in another medical career. Kerrigan, you just went back to school recently, face-to-face, first time since March. So how did it go?
Well, it went very well. I really enjoyed myself. It was a lot different than in years past, you know. So as I went into it, I didn't have a lot of expectations just because I wanted to have an open mind and see what I would get from it. In typical school years, you know, I would go in and we would have like an assembly with students. We would all kind of have a celebration, like a pep rally almost, and just kind of celebrate the new school year. And that didn't happen this year. A lot of normal things that we would normally get to do didn't happen this year. But nonetheless, I had a great time. I got to spend time with those that have last names M through Z, and it was a lot of fun. The administrators did a wonderful job, and we just had a good school day. Everything went smoothly, and I really enjoyed myself, and I'm very grateful that I got to go.
Give us some examples of what was different.
The biggest difference for me, I would say, was just wearing the masks and the social distancing. But other than that, I would say another huge difference that I noticed was that only half the school was there, less than half of the school was there. We have it divided so that last names A through L attend school on Monday and Wednesday, and then M through Z will attend on Tuesday and Thursdays. So it was very different because a lot of the people that I typically go to school with weren't there. A lot of the faces that I'm used to seeing weren't there. So that was a lot different than in years past, but it was a lot of fun. So,
do you think that the students and teachers and staff felt comfortable, or do you think everybody was still maybe a little scared? What was the mood that you felt?
Personally, I really thought that everyone felt comfortable. I know I felt very comfortable from the moment I walked into the building. You know, we first walked in through the back entrance. I got my temperature taken, and there are arrows all over the floor that lead you into the right direction. So as you're walking down the hallway, you're not meeting any oncoming traffic. So as you're walking, people aren't walking in the opposite direction, kind of breathing on you, that kind of thing. We were all spaced out well in all the classrooms. There weren't, you know, we weren't at capacity, so there was a lot of space. There was a lot of, you know, room to just be kept away from everyone else, I would say, even at lunch.
Do you think you and your classmates will be able to keep up the masks and the social distancing as the year goes on, or do you think people may get tired of it?
Well, I do think so. I think yesterday was probably the hardest day. Just because as far as masks are concerned, I think that might have been the longest period of time that a lot of those students had worn a mask. And so I think that once we get over that initial kind of getting used to it, it will get easier and it'll become a routine, like putting your shoes on in the morning, you'll put your mask on. And I think that as we go on throughout the school year, it'll become second nature and people will be able to just, you know, go right along with it and get used to it, because that's how it was at GSP over the summer. I know the first day was not the best. It was so hard to keep my mask on, you know, and it was uncomfortable. But by the end, like, I noticed that I would just leave my mask on and I would get back to my dorm when I could take it off, and it would still be on for like 30 minutes afterward because I wouldn't even realize it was on. So I think that'll be the case mostly.
Tell us what GSP is that you just mentioned.
Well, this past summer, I attended the Governor's Scholars Program on Center's campus, and typically that program lasts about 5 weeks, I'm pretty sure, and for me, it was about 5 days. And we go and you meet with other scholars from around the state of Kentucky and you participate in a summer program. We do a lot of activities with one another and we go to class in a focus area. Mine happened to be philosophy. And then we attend classes like a seminar class where we talk about issues in our world and different things. So it's really just an organization that gets students in Kentucky together to learn from one another and to get to have a summer experience away from home to really just learn as a group of Kentucky students.
And you also mentioned earlier that you're a cheerleader, and of course in Kentucky school sports got started a little sooner than most of the face-to-face classes in schools. So in cheerleading and school sports, how's that working in this new virus world?
Well, it's definitely different, but I would say that it's working really well. You know, as we cheer on the sidelines, we keep our masks up the whole time, so that's very safe. When we stunt, however, we can pull our masks down. As KHSAA recently ruled, we're allowed to pull our masks down when we stunt. However, a lot of times we just keep our masks up. And then as far as practicing, we do keep our masks on. We stay socially distant as much as we can, which is a big change from years past, because cheerleading is a sport where you touch and you know, you're really close to your teammates the entire time. So that was really different, and we do stay apart. We do get our temperatures taken and wear masks, which is unlike any year before this year, but yeah. It is a lot of fun.
Well, good. So this is your senior year. Big year. What are your hopes for the upcoming year, and then what are you really worried about?
Well, previously, my biggest hope for senior year was just a sense of normalcy. You know, being able to have homecoming and school dances and just things that we would typically get to do as a school, you know, things that are unique to our school. I mean, even small things like rock moves, which is something we do where we have a day where we all just kind of spend time outside and participate in different activities to get everyone moving. I mean, things like that I just really looked forward to and was hoping that we would get some piece of that this year. But as time goes on, I'm starting to kind of get away from that idea, and I'm just looking forward to making the most of it. You know, this is the situation. We just got to make the best of it when life gives you lemons. And I just hope that I just have a good school year with my peers and with my teachers. I learn a lot, and I can better handle adversity in future situations.
Well, that's a great attitude, and I hope it does get more normal for all of us.
I hope so.
So your future, you're possibly planning a career in public health or other areas of the medical field. So how have your experiences since March impacted your views towards public health and your future career?
Throughout this time that we've been in quarantine and the pandemic, my interest in public health has grown so much just because I've been able to see how important it is and how valuable of a career that is, because I've been able to see the importance of it and just how much weight that the public health workers are carrying during this time.
Well, I hope you get to keep going back to school face-to-face, and I hope it works out. And by the end of the year, maybe, hopefully, things will be normal, and hopefully you'll get to have prom and all those things.
Yes, I really hope so.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it as well.
Coming up after the break, a murder.
One of the things that keeps me coming back to it is that every time I dig and I look and I, you know, drill down to some of the people involved in this, I find something surprising.
Our Appalachian story,
the huge important story of the region hasn't been properly told despite many efforts by many people to get it told.
And a refresher on the virtues of democracy.
Here's how to live a decent life with your neighbor, with your family, with your brothers and sisters, with all those in your neighborhood, in your state, in your country.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, and Kayla Combs provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and personal injuries. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Something both strange and horrible happened in Lexington many, many years ago, and now there's a book about it. Tom Eblen explores.
In the decade before America entered World War II, Marion Miley of Lexington was one of the nation's best amateur women golfers. The 27-year-old was attractive and charming and became something of an international celebrity. But everything changed in the early hours of September 28, 1941. During a botched robbery at her family's apartment at the Lexington Country Club, Miley was murdered and her mother was mortally wounded. The crime made headlines around the world, including a front-page story in the New York Times. Lexington writer Beverly Bell has spent years researching Marion Miley and her murder. Now, 79 years later, she tells the young woman's story in a compelling true crime novel, The Murder of Marion Miley, published by South Limestone, an imprint of the University Press of Kentucky. Beverly Bell is with us today to talk about her book. Beverly, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, tell us briefly about Marion Miley and what happened to her.
Well, Marion Miley was one of this country's elite women golfers from about the mid-1930s until 1941. It was that year she was living with her mother, Elsie Miley, in a second-floor apartment at the Lexington Country Club. Her mother was the office manager for the club, and Marion's father, Fred Miley, was the former golf pro, but he had taken probably a better-paying job at a bigger private club in Cincinnati. In late September of 1941, two ex-convicts broke into the country club and then into the locked apartment where Marion and her mother lived. They robbed them. They shot both women. Marion died instantly. I think her mother lived for about three more days. And it set off a nationwide manhunt, really because of Marion's celebrity and the fact that she had traveled in this sort of upper echelon of women golfers for a number of years. And frankly, because she was so young, she was 27 years old when it happened, and it really was a brutal death.
What interested you about this old case and the woman herself?
Yes, and you're so kind to call it interest, because I think sometimes it was sort of like I was compelled, obsessed with
obsession.
It. That might be another way to say it. Yes, I was very interested in. You know, I'm a writer, and I think for most writers, it comes down to one thing. Is it a compelling story? Does it hold your interest? And I can tell you that from the moment I heard this story for the first time many years ago, everything from you know, her life as this extraordinary and famous person to the horrific death after she was shot in the head. I was absolutely hooked by the story. It took me a very long time to put all the pieces together. I was working at other things and, you know, going on with my life. But I will tell you that there was never a time, not once in all those years, did my enthusiasm for it fade. Every time I would pick it up, I would go, oh my gosh, yes, this is so interesting. And I can't believe this happened. So, you know, if you can have that feeling over that number of years for a story, you've got something good and you should hold on to it and you should see it through, which is what I did.
Well, were you able to uncover much new information with all the investigations you did?
I did. Things that I thought added a lot of extra flavor, extra insights to the overall story. For example, I learned that Fred Miley, Marion's father and Elsie's husband, of course, died as an alcoholic. After their death, he became an alcoholic, and that stayed with him for the rest of his life. I learned that he remarried a woman who was much younger than he was, but before he would agree to marry her, he made her promise that there would be no children, because, as he said, if something were to happen to that child, he simply couldn't bear it. I was also able to read probably more than 70 letters that one of the men, Tom Penny, who was convicted and died for this crime, he wrote these letters to his mother while he was at Eddyville State Penitentiary awaiting execution. He was a prolific letter writer. And you can see from virtually the first letter the huge remorse he felt, the constant worry over his children. He had two children. He kept wondering what is going to happen to them now that I have done this. You know, what is their future going to be like? It was just really extraordinary to have that. So I think that those experiences really informed the way I wrote it. I write the story from three perspectives, from Fred Miley, from Marion's best friend, Francis Laval, and from the perspective of Tom Penny. And I think those insights just really put what I call flesh on the bones, because you can see them as real human beings going through this experience, you know, at least for Francis and for Fred, of losing someone they loved so much, and what that is like, you know, how you take your life forward after you experience such a shocking loss. And then, of course, for Tom Penny, it was just the reality of facing what he had done, what he had been a part of, and how, you know, how wrong it was, and just the enormous amount of guilt that he felt because of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, why did you decide to write this as a novel rather than as a nonfiction crime book?
Well, you have to understand that this is a novel very much grounded in fact and in true events. That was extremely important to me. I wanted to get the foundation right. I wanted to understand all the different elements of what had actually happened, the people involved. But it also became pretty clear to me early on that I couldn't tell the story the way I wanted to as nonfiction. It wasn't enough for me just to tell the facts of, you know, Marion's incredible career and, you know, all of her victories. And it certainly wasn't enough for me to focus on all the facts of the crime. I really wanted to capture the emotion. And to do that, I had to sort of get inside these people's brains as far as I could understand it. And I needed dialogue to do that. And I needed the freedom of fiction to create the dialogue and the overall feeling that I was trying to communicate. fiction was the only answer for me.
Yeah, well, it worked really well, I must say.
Okay.
What do you think readers will find most interesting about or surprising about the book?
It's kind of funny, you know, now that the book is out, I'm starting to hear some reactions from readers. And the thing that I have heard mentioned quite a few times is the how surprised they are of how Elsie Miley, Marion's mother, after being shot three times, she was able to crawl from the Lexington Country Club to a sanitarium. It was a sanitarium at the time. It's a private residence now, but it was across the road from the country club. It's probably about 200 yards, which is the equivalent of, you know, think of two football fields. And it just seems that that is something that really surprises, and they can't believe that she was able to do that with three gunshot wounds. And, you know, my answer to them, I said, look, I think it just speaks to a mother's love and her desperation to save her child. So that is one thing that I didn't think that people would react to, but they did. But for me, I think the thing that kind of got my attention was what I called Marion's Forrest Gump moments. And if you remember the movie, Forrest Gump had all these incredible interactions with famous people, even, you know, iconic moments of history. And, you know, I always say that for Forrest Gump, it was all fiction. But Marion, on the other hand, actually knew all kinds of famous people and had all these interactions, and they were real. You know, she met the former King of England, who had abdicated his throne in 1936 to marry an American divorcee, Wallace Simpson. So, you know, Marion met them. She knew Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, two of the most famous people of the first half of the 20th century. She played golf with them. She stayed at their homes. You know, she met Clark Gable and Ruby Keeler. She played golf with Happy Chandler. I mean, it just kind of goes on and on. She knew all kinds of business people. And you just think, how could this happen? You know, this girl in her 20s. But it was the game of golf that gave her an incredible opening and kind of almost a calling card of introduction. And it just, she had the chance to interact with all these famous people. And there is just one other thing that I think is kind of surprising, at least it was for me, in doing the research for this book. There were all these, like, really surprising things that I would uncover, and I experienced that over and over and over again. I'll just tell you a couple. So I already mentioned that Tom Penny was one of the people who committed the crime. Well, he was also distantly related to a person named James Cash Penny, who we would probably know better as the founder of J.C. Penney. There was a reporter who did an interview with Tom Penny right after he got arrested, and he was with a Texas paper, the Star-Telegraph. He ended up being the press secretary for President Lyndon Johnson. The doctor who operated on Elsie Miley, trying to save her life after she had been shot three times, was the son-in-law of Charles Mayo. Charles Mayo was one of the founders of the Mayo Clinic. It's just kind of discoveries like those that would always just kind of jar me a little bit. I would, and like I said, it happened over and over and over again. And I remember specifically saying to someone as I was writing this book, you know, one of the things that keeps me coming back to it is that every time I dig and I look and I, you know, drill down to some of the people involved in this, I find something surprising. And that's kind of a crazy reward when you think about it, and it really motivates you to keep working and to keep digging, and it certainly did that for me.
All right. Well, thank you, Beverly Bell. And the book, again, is The Murder of Marion Miley, a fascinating story and a great read. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Tom Eblin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. How Appalachian Kentucky and its people are portrayed to the rest of the world has not always been flattering. Sometimes it's been quite damaging, not to mention discouraging. And often it ignores a rich and diverse cultural history. The Kentucky Historical Society's Stephanie Lang begins a new series on Eastern Standard with a conversation about these perceptions.
Joining me today is Catherine Newfont, an associate professor of history at the University of Kentucky. She is the author of Blue Ridge Commons, Environmental Activism and Forest History in Western North Carolina. She is also the past president of the Appalachian Studies Association, and most recently, I had the wonderful pleasure to work with her as guest editor of a special issue of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, Beyond the War on Poverty, Appalachia Post-1970. I do have to say that it's kind of interesting when we got together and were talking about this project now a couple of years ago. Appalachia was forefront in the national conversation following the presidential election of 2016 and also the release of J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, the book.
Right.
It's very interesting to think in all of the weirdness of 2020 that we're kind of back talking about these issues again. We're facing another contentious presidential election. And J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy is back yet again, except this time in movie form.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly some of the issues that we were talking about for this issue not only called into question time-worn stereotypes and debates surrounding economic, racial, and environmental concerns, they've stirred a new outpouring of scholarship, including this issue that examines Appalachia as it enters into a post-coal era. And for this particular issue, we decided to focus on after the war on poverty, you know, trying to get out of that particular shadow.
Right.
What do you think the articles in this issue tell us about the region today?
Well, Stephanie, it's a pleasure to be here and to celebrate this special issue because there really is a lot that it brings. And one of the things, there are many things to like about it, but one of the things that I particularly appreciate is the way it works against the flattening and damaging stereotypes that we too often see, including in present day media representations. And I love the way it gets at the diversity of the region, the human diversity of the region's participants. I love the way it emphasizes innovation and experimentation. And the region's often depicted as a passive region, and I love the way it focuses our attention on active work and decision making and movement building and so on. So for all those reasons, I think it's bringing a lot to the discussions of the region since 1970.
And you mentioned some of the activism that's going on. So let's talk a little bit about the articles themselves, one of which is by Tammy Clemens, and it looks at activism across different generations, not only war on poverty generation, but also current.
Right.
Other articles, you know, talk about migration, the mid-20th century migration, particularly north to industrial centers looking for work. There are other articles that are actually taking to task Hillbilly Elegy, the religious bent of that.
Right, exactly. The way Hillbilly Elegy tends to flatten out what's actually a very much more diverse landscape of religious history and religious present-day practice than is depicted in Hillbilly Elegy. And the migrations piece shows how the reach of the Appalachians moves into urban areas such as Cincinnati, right? That the region is not only in the mountains, it also exists beyond the mountains in places like Cincinnati. And then, yeah, Tammy's wonderful piece about activism past and present. I love the way it looks both at the work that so many activists did in the war on poverty era and shortly after that, and then also at the very present day outpouring of youth activism that is occurring and really transforming the region right now.
Certainly. And we worked really, really hard with this issue to assemble a very diverse chorus of voices and perspectives from the region. And one of those actually includes the Register's first LGBTQ article.
I know.
What surprised you most about some of these, and what are some new directions that you hope will come from these conversations?
Okay, well, I do want to talk about that, but I want to linger on your point for a moment, Stephanie, about how this is the Register's first article on LGBTQ history. That's important for a number of reasons. One is that, of course, Kentucky has a robust LGBTQ history. It's just not something that's been covered or researched properly or brought into the open. So I'm really excited that Jonathan Coleman has done this piece on, which is just delightfully titled, Old Kentucky Homo, on Lige Clark's gay liberation. And one of the things that I love about this piece happening in this special issue is the way it troubles the way people tend to think about the Appalachians. We don't think of Appalachians as being in the forefront of gay liberation, but that's essentially Jonathan's argument here, is that Lige Clark is drawing on his, that he is very much a mover and shaker in the broader conversations about around gay liberation. He's literally kind of the poster boy for gay liberation in New York, and that he is drawing on his Eastern Kentucky roots to make the kinds of contributions that he's making, that he's an innovator and that he is a nationally important figure, and he is also very much an Appalachian. And so I love the fact that one of the surprises here, I think, for most readers of the Register will be that this special issue on the Appalachians is also the first time that the Register has published a piece on gay liberation in Kentucky.
We've talked certainly about new directions that we want Appalachian studies as a whole to take, but what kind of directions do you hope are going to come from these conversations?
First, I hope that people beyond the Appalachian region will begin to have a better understanding of just how complex and diverse the Appalachian region is, and not continue to flatten it with these demeaning and, well, wrong stereotypes that people carry around in their heads without even realizing it sometimes. So there's so much evidence in this of innovation, experimentation, really cutting edge thinking and experimentation that has come out of the region. And we haven't mentioned yet Carson Benn's piece on distance education, for instance, which I love because that, again, you were talking about how contemporary so much of this material is, and obviously distance education since the pandemic has become even more important than it was going into the pandemic. And Carson does a great job looking at how people in Eastern Kentucky were, again, innovators, experimenters. They were working on figuring out ways to deliver distance education at a much earlier era and doing it with what were then cutting edge technology such as satellite networks and television. So I love the way that it posits school teachers and local schools as well as institutions of higher education in the Appalachians as active participants and shapers of this large experiment. So again, we don't think of the Appalachian region as being on the technical cutting edge, and yet Carson has demonstrated this case in which that clearly was true.
I think one of the most important things about this particular issue is the fact that all of us involved have very personal connections to the region. We're from there. We have family who's from there. So getting that sort of narrative out by people in the region, from the region, how do you think that these authors and ultimately the issue itself work against false stereotypes, and what do they say about diversity in the region?
Yeah, well, I think you hit on one really important point here, Stephanie, which is that so many of the voices featured in this special issue are voices from the region itself. The region has suffered a lot from a lot of people outside it talking about it, and fewer people inside it being listened to as they talk about and offer their own analyses of the region and what it has to offer and so on. Your interview, for instance, with John Rosenberg is a wonderful example of this, where this is another arena where people don't think of the Jewish history in the Appalachians. We're just now beginning to unearth some of that history, just as we are with LGBTQ history in the Appalachians. So Deborah Wiener has a wonderful book, Coalfield Jews, that looks at Jewish history in the Appalachian region, but there's a lot more to do. And I love the fact, the way that that interview, it literally features John Rosenberg's voice talking about his work in the region, his life in the region, his experience as a Jewish person living and working in the Appalachian region, very closely with Appalachian people. So that, I think, is important, that these are voices emerging from the region, offering their own perspectives on what's important and the future of the region, as well as its past, rather than being framed by people outside the region looking in with a often far less complex understanding of the region itself.
One of the last things that I want to touch on is your introduction to the issue that you wrote as guest editor. I have to say that it's probably one of my favorites, and you lay bare the issues in the mountains, but you also give a really interesting call to arms, if you will. The intro uses bloodroot, mm-hmm. Which is a plant that when it's cut or broken, it has a reddish color that comes from it. And you also use that to paint a vivid picture of the mountains as a war zone. Talk about how and why you crafted the intro the way you did and what you hope people learn about communities in Appalachia.
Yeah, well, the intro really emerged from our work together on the issue, Stephanie, as well as my work on the Appalachian Studies Association conference and the voices of the authors. As you know, I came to Kentucky from North Carolina, and my work up to this point had centered on Western North Carolina, which is also Appalachian, but different from Kentucky. And one of the steep learning curves for me coming to Kentucky has been learning about, really, frankly, the degree of violence that has been visited on Eastern Kentucky. The quote that stands out to me, Herb Reed and Betsy Taylor talked about how with mountaintop removal, the equivalent of the amount of explosive power that leveled Hiroshima at the end of World War II was, you know, visited on Eastern Kentucky every week. That's astonishing, and is a huge, important story of the region that hasn't been properly told, despite many efforts by many people to get it told. So I'm really kind of stunned by the level of violence that has been visited. We haven't talked about Black Appalachians here, but the invisibilizing of Black Appalachian people is another piece of that violence. And I'm very inspired by the way Appalachian people, including Black Appalachians, have worked against all that. So the bloodroot image for me is important, not only because of the breakage and the bleeding that bloodroot, that image, but also the way it emerges in the spring. And the image comes from an Appalachian teacher, really, himself. And I drew that from the archives at UK. I stumbled on that article and was really moved by that image. So I hope that the era of breakage may be coming to an end in the Appalachians, and the era of renewal, I see many signs that that is happening. That's my hope, is that we put more energy toward that renewal and that we collectively work to halt the violence that has been visited on Eastern Kentucky for far too long.
Well, Kathy, it was wonderful to talk to you today, and also wonderful to work with you on this special issue. If you are interested in learning more about how to pick up an issue, you can contact the Kentucky Historical Society. Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks so much, Stephanie.
And in coming editions of Eastern Standard, Stephanie Lang talks with Jonathan Coleman and Carson Benn. I want to take just a few moments to welcome a new guest interviewer to our growing list of contributors. You can find them all under the series tab on our site, esweku.org. With me on the phone from Winchester is Father Jim Trimble, priest in charge at Emmanuel Episcopal Church, and the focus of this series, Our Compass, the Virtues of a Democracy. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jim Trimble.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
Well, as I mentioned, the series that you will host on Eastern Standard will look at America's social compass, the pillars of a functioning democracy, and that would be the set of virtues that kind of serve as an owner's manual for getting along in a diverse society such as ours. What will we hear in this series?
Well, what I'd like to do is use Aristotle's 12 virtues as a jumping off point of exploration, conversation, and discussion. Things like courage, ambition, patience, wit, modesty, justice, and talk with various folks, whether they be professors or writers or artists or firemen, newspaper reporters, and see from their lenses how people interact with each other along these lines of virtuous behavior, whether we even claim ourselves as virtuous, or is even the term virtue so unattainable in this day and age, or have we made it so unattainable, where in fact it's probably one of the most ordinary things for ordinary people. It's not just the Gandhi or the Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King. It's everybody.
And so we're talking about virtues that are shared across the spectrum of religious ideologies.
Oh, absolutely. You know, whether it be Judeo-Christian virtues or other faith traditions, there's that commonality of here's how to live a decent life with your neighbor, with your family, with your brothers and sisters, with all those in your neighborhood, in your state, in your country. And can that even translate into the corporate world? Can it translate into families? Can it translate into all sorts of things? But those 12 virtues are the way that we live with each other and how we can direct our own moral compass and hopefully help our business, our work, our country, our family, our schools, everything.
Father Jim Trimble is priest in charge at Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Winchester and soon to host a series on the virtues of democracy here on Eastern Standard. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you, especially your ideas. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.